that there is no difference between the horizontal and the vertical until you get after sundown, about 45 minutes to an hour after the sun goes down. Now the vertical pulls into its own almost every time. But as I mentioned, on a lot of occasions, not always, but on a lot of occasions, before sundown, I can't notice any real difference between the horizontal and the vertical.
I think you've seen that antenna. That's a 180-foot long, four-element, fully rotatable, horizontally polarized, 80-meter beam by 7J4 Alpha Lima Lima. Have you seen that antenna? Or there's also a JR3 that has one. I wonder if you've seen that, Barry.
Yes, I have. I've seen pictures of it. He's standing in it, actually. I think he should come up with a way to turn that vertical. That's what I think.
Oh, wow. I can picture those elements swinging in polarization, that whole boom rotating in polarization. Those elements would have to wave through that great big building it's mounted on, Barry.
Yeah, but I think he'd see at least a 6 dB advantage if he could do it. When he's trying to work the U.S. and stuff like that, I really think it would be worth the trouble if he could do it. In other words, he's losing an awful lot because of that horizontal polarization. That's really how I'm beginning to see it.
Yeah, my belief is that he would get more and more benefit as he goes more and more vertical. If he can only steer at 45 degrees in polarization, I think it's going to give him at least half of the benefit. And he could do that. The first thing he's got to do on that thing, he's got to put a weather vane on it so he doesn't grind up rotators. The last I heard, he's grinding up rotators. Either he's keeping that quiet or he's solved the problem. What do you think?
I don't know. I think he has some kind of weather vane. I saw a picture of it, and it had some kind of a tail of an airplane kind of sticking out the other end. But I don't know how successful it's been.
Fantastic. 2 or 3 years ago, I told him to do that. Maybe I was the 30th person that told him. I never got a reply, and if he did it, I'll be happy. Okay. Mel, you can discuss this, any subject you like. Mailbag. K2KEY, K2LIW.
Okay, this is K2KEY. Yeah, in fact, I looked down some list of questions here, and one of them is that question. I have a half-wave dipole that's vertically polarized for 40 meters. And 40 meters, at least, you know, it gets a little bit more shorter than an 80-meter antenna, so I can do some experiments with it. And I found, and that's what the question is, you said that took into the four, you used the four different angles. I did four different angles. It started out with, of course, the vertical dipole, the halfway vertical dipole on 40 at 90 degrees. I then moved it out to 75, and I tried 60, and I tried about a 45 degree. In other words, more or less coming more or less, I fixed it towards the slope up. But I found that the 60-degree, approximately the 60-degree setting, it gave me, on 40 meters, it seems that I would say that it just gave me a better hearing of BX station on 40, just on CW. I've been trying it, I've been only using it on CW. So, no doubt that shifting the radiation, vertical radiation pattern, that there is most likely, possibly, you may find that, again, depending on what your location, it may create a higher angle of radiation or, you know, shift from the normal going vertical, or, it's so hard to, you know, say what's going to happen at each particular location. But I definitely found that shifting the vertical dipole, which has its top, that 66 meters top, and moving it to make a 60-degree angle with the ground, seems to be about the most effective, at least on 40 meters in my location, Dick, over.
When you say 60 degrees of a vertical dipole with reference to the ground, does that mean it's really a kind of a sloper, Mel? Go ahead.
I guess you could, that's why I say, you consider a sloper, normally they were always considering a slope or somewhere around 45 degrees. That's the, you know, the I guess the classic definition that you'll find in a lot of the manuals on antennas that you know, put up a slope or a slope at 45 degrees. I would assume that you're getting towards a sloper, and it just seems like whether it's now at the conditions that we're going through, this, of course, again, you know, we're factoring in ionosphere conditions, and it's a situation that right now we're going possibly at this part of the propagation that maybe moving it from that vertical, pure vertical, gives you a little bit of the best of two worlds, somewhat horizontal and somewhere vertical, think over.
Okay, I see that. But I'm suddenly sitting here thinking, I know why vertical dipoles are so unpopular. Everyone would think, particularly on a band like 40 meters for sure and 80 meters and 160, really, very few people have enough vertical altitude of a support structure to do it. That's item number one. Number two, if I was building a pure vertical dipole against a metal tower, common sense would lead you to believe the tower is a short circuit. It's a small fraction of a wavelength away. It's the same polarization as the vertical dipole. It represents a short circuit. The whole antenna ain't going to work. Everyone is forgetting the magic of resonance. The dipole, the thing that you're feeding, is a resonance structure. And therefore, by the laws of physics, the way the signal bounces back and forth, a whole lot of times where it gets radiated, it's a high Q structure, it develops from the resonance a great big effective capture area. This great big ellipse around that wire that's got 8,500 square feet of area in the case of 80 meters. The tower itself is not resonant. It casts a shadow on your big ellipse of effective area of a couple of percent. Very similar to what happens with a horizontal dipole that happens to be mounted at the exact same altitude as your Con Ed wiring that's across the street or the LiPo wiring that's across the street. The Con Ed or the LiPo wiring is not resonant and it's transparent. Yeah, I'll admit that if the bulk big transformer is arcing over, you're going to get some QR Nancy. I'll give you that. And maybe it's going to take an extremely good noise blanket to take that back out. But other than that, that horizontal wire of the power line ain't resonant. So here we are with a vertical dipole against a vertical tower, and as long as the tower isn't resonant, you got no problem. And even if the tower is resonant, you can do some playing around with the guy wires to kill that resonance. So therefore, the tower is 98%, so to speak, transparent to the vertical radiation. But the lack of understanding of that concept, I think, is the reason we have not seen a significant number of vertical dipoles to date. And here we have a couple of guys that have put their toe in the water, they started experimenting with it, and they say, wow, this thing is a winner. And we're all sitting here saying, why hasn't someone discovered this before? I think I've got a guess as to maybe why. K2KEY, K2LIW.
Okay, this is K2KEY. Well, if you look at some of the literature, read it closely, there's been always some kind of belief that for low frequency, now we're looking at, say, 80 meters strictly, tilting a vertical could possibly permit the utilization of some of the net gain, you know, of a halfway vertical over a quarter wave of vertical. So, I believe that's possibly, you know, you're taking a halfway dipole and you're moving it so that, of course, the feed point is going to be at least 33 feet above ground. So it's possibility, you see, there's where you're picking it up. You're picking up possibly a radiation below 30 degrees. This is most likely, like I can say, this is talking about work CX. This has got to be the factor why these works better in the horizontal antenna, because you're picking up most likely the radiation angle of below 30 degrees. That's what I can only account for it over.
Okay, the fact that you've got vertical polarization at all And the fact that the ground reflection out there a mile away in front of your antenna does not do phase inversion, phase inversion, because it's vertical, is where a lot of the benefit is coming from. That gives you a very low angle of radiation. Now, if I slope the antenna away from the tower, so that the bottom, the top of the antenna is very close to the tower with an egg insulator, the bottom of the half-wave antenna is sloped away from the tower in the direction of the northeast, does that give me, in your opinion, a more desirable vertical angle of radiation to the northeast than if I brought it down to the southeast? If I want to talk northeast, I want to talk Europe, do I slope the bottom of the antenna in that direction, Mel? K2KEY, K2RIW.
That's what it seems like. That's right. That basically, I guess if you have a method, you most likely, if you were able to take the bottom of that antenna, leaving it, like you say, with a pivot point up at the top of the tower, something that you, in other words, that'd be freewheeling up there, and, you know, stretch the wire down nice and tight at about a 60-degree angle, and be able to put a hoop around this thing or some way, you know, walk it around, I will bet you you're going to see a difference. Just even with a single element, Dick, just with that one piece of wire, you're going to see, I'm sure, a difference. I'm positive, because it is going to exhibit a lobe. Now, what kind of lobe would it, you know, exhibit? From what I've seen, you look like, whereas at 90 degrees, you know, the lobe will look, you know, like a nice, you know, half of a circle somewhere. Yeah, I guess with a takeoff somewhere around 60 degrees. With a pure vertical, I think the takeoff angle will be 60 degrees. As you start to move it, you'll see that the takeoff angle, as you slope it out, at one point the takeoff angle is going to drop. And I think at that point, when it drops to around 30 degrees or less, I think that's where you get the advantage over.
That would be an extremely interesting experiment if you got a high enough tower. Start off with the vertical dipole offset to the side of the tower, a pure vertical dipole offset to the side of the tower, I'll pick a number, 5 feet, at top and bottom. Then while it's operating, either receiving or transmitting, you take the bottom of this thing and walk it away from the tower so it eventually tilts 30 degrees with reference to the vertical, or 60 degrees with reference to the ground. You're suggesting that as I walk the bottom of the dipole away from the tower toward the northeast, that the signal to the northeast will improve. My gut feel is that the improvement is going to be small, but you feel that it's going to be controlling the elevation angle of takeoff in that direction. My feeling on this one is that whenever you've got an antenna on an HF frequency, the ground is close to being a mirror. And so I've got a real antenna above the ground. I've got a mirror image of the antenna below the ground. If the bottom of the sloper is tilted, is away from the tower toward the northeast, then I can picture the mirror image of that is starting at ground level, sloped away from the tower, and then the mirror image goes down to the ground, so to speak, and rejoins the tower, the mirror image of the tower. So now I've really made a pair of vertically stacked dipoles, co-phase, and I've tilted them in such a way that the junction between the two, the real and the image, is being pulled away from the tower. But if I combine the above ground radiation from the below ground radiation, the mirror image, I think I haven't steered the beam vertically, assuming I'm getting 100% ground reflection. That's my gut feel, but I think it's going to take modeling on a good program to prove this. Is there anybody with the sound of our voice that's good at computer modeling this and can find out what happened? What's your opinion on that one, Mel? K2KEY, K2RIW.
I did it. That's exactly what I do. I used the L-neck, the mini-neck, and looked at what I could see. You know, see, the problem is, again, you just hit the magic word, ground. What kind of ground is under it? And this is the big variance. If you look at Mini-Neck, I know they say over average ground. What is average ground, Dick? Our ground is what, between 5 and 10 MS per meter or something? I think this is the ground that we have here in this part of the country. Am I correct, over?
Yeah, we're in central Long Island. I'm guessing our ground is somewhat average. But for the people in Far Rockaway and for the people in Manhattan Beach, an area of Long Island which has on a couple of occasions in the past been overwashed with seawater, and seawater is an extremely conductive surface substance. If I had to make a guess, I'm guessing that Barry's ground and your ground is a hell of a lot higher in conductivity than the clay-bearing soil that's under my feet. Now back to you, Mel.
Well, that's hard to say because, yeah, well, overwashed. It hasn't been overwashed by seawater here, thankfully. You know, let the sea stay where it is, 350 feet to my south. I'm not looking for it to come here. Please, I've seen that. It can create a havoc. According, again, let's go back to Mini-Neck. I know it's an old program, the Mini-Neck, a set of programs, newer programs, but I got so used to it, you know, I'm set my ways, like my daughter says, dinosaur. I did some modeling with it, and they, according to Mini-Neck, if you take the halfway vertical, and you have supposedly a 10-degree takeoff field that you can achieve by slowly tilting it away from the vertical, leaving the top, like you say, joined up there or whatever, structure top of the tree or the mic I'm using, and move it away. According to Mini-Neck, that you can achieve a 3.7 dB greater than the field of a half-wave dipole at 45 degrees or a vertical, or at the vertical, original vertical position. In other words, you're moving away. As you move away, when you get to that magical, you drop below the 30-degree takeoff, you will possibly, at one point, achieve a 10-degree takeoff, which supposedly is going to give you this 3.7 dB gain. And then as you move to the 45-degree point, somewhere in that point and all, you're going to find out that you're beginning again to now increase the angle towards the 30-degree takeoff. I can say, take this with a grain of salt, Dick, over.
No, you may be right. The ground is not a pure conductor. It is a resistive material with some capacitive effects to it. Therefore, the wave traveling along the ground is slightly slowed. That means that a pure vertical antenna would tend to launch a wave slightly into the ground, not above the ground. And by bringing the bottom of the dipole away from the support structure, you're starting to tilt things back in the other direction. This slowing of the wave that's parallel to the ground, or the portion of the wave that's closer to the ground, it's a subset of what's called the Brewster angle effect. A pure vertical polarization at certain critical angles into a dielectric medium experiences a null in the reflection. And so your local ground may behave in that way. And so by sloping away from the base of the tower, I think you're partially correcting that. I also think this inverted V that Barry's talking about, and you're talking about with the K3 Lima Romeo article, which I've got to look up, the inverted V, I think, also partially does that. I'm not sure.
I think I found that article. It's not what Mel said. It's something else.
Okay, go ahead, Barry. Give it to me.
Yeah, you're going to find it on Contact Systems. And it's a little tricky, but go to Contact Systems, C-O-N-T-K, Systems. And you're looking for something called Page 6. It's a little tricky to find it. You got to search all over his website. You find something called Page 6. and he gives you two different diagrams of this thing with a lot of explanations, and it's hard to explain them. The best thing to do is just look at it.
When you said Comtech Systems, is that Charlie Oscar Mike or Charlie Oscar November T-E-K? Go ahead.
Yeah, Mike. C-O-M-T-E-K.
Okay, your particular microphone right now is low in volume and also low in the high frequency notes. That makes it a little bit difficult. Comtech Systems, and I think you said page 6, P-A-G-E 6. Is that true?
Yes, that's correct. I just turned the gain up. You know, I plugged this mic in the back of this ICOM, and I had the same thing on my other one. I don't understand this, but when I plug it in the back, I don't get enough gain. When I plug it in the front, it works great. And this is not the first time I run into this. This model is the 7000 and also the other one. I thought there was something wrong with the other one. I guess not.
You've got a lot more audio from the front. Still a tiny bit low, but you came up 10 dB or 8 dB in audio. So, Mel, you probably haven't yet used MiniNet to model the inverted V vertical light dipole. You know, the arrow aimed to the northeast, we'll say. But I'd love to know what kind of vertical takeoff angle it has. And should it be a pure vertical inverted V, or should it be an inverted V that's moved in the sloper direction, if you know what I mean? K2KE1, K2LIW.
Okay, this is K2KE1. Looking right at the this thing right now, it says here, Comtech System, designed by K3LR, K3. Louis Radio, as described in his two-part CQ series. That's right. Remember now, with CQ Magazine, he did a two-part on this thing and described this whole business of how he switches it back and forth and all the deals, Dick. And he licensed it out, I guess, to Comtech, because Comtech seems to be marketing his antenna system. And he gets for, see, I'm looking here, he sells a four-square version of it. Now, this is with the phasing and all this. It's 160 meters, $349.95 for 80 meters, $339.95. Dick, this is what I was referring to. Barry, I think he may be referring to another article, but this is the article that I saw in the magazine, Dick, over.
Yeah, Mel?
Go ahead, Barry.
Yeah, what Comtech is selling is really the phasing system, which is, I'm not interested in that. I know that makes it simple for a lot of guys, but he's pretty much telling you, go build your own wires, you know, do that, and he'll just sell you the phasing system. But what's good about his website is he's giving you the diagram of how he laid out the antennas in a couple of different versions, which is really interesting. I mean, I'm going to do it inverted V style, you know, vertically polarized inverted V, but he has some other approaches which I never even considered. I can't even explain them. You got to look at them.
Barry, what does he do with the phasing harness? Does that make it into a Yagi-like structure that gives him a good front-to-back ratio? Is he steering front-to-back, or is he steering the beam or steering the null? What's he doing with the phasing harness?
Okay, well, I'm not sure, but what he's got is two pieces. One of them is a hub that mounts on your tower, and I guess he's using coax in this case, and it all comes to this hub. And there's an electronic switch in there, and there's a little switch control box that you put in your shack. I don't really want to do all that. I mean, I don't think it's necessary, but he's giving you impedance matching and all that sort of stuff. And he's already pre-doing the phase length, you know, between the dipoles. He's got that all set up for you in advance, and I'm not so sure I want to do that because I don't necessarily agree with his length on the phasing.
You said you don't agree with his length on the phasing. Give me a couple of words on that one, Barry.
Yeah, because we had a discussion about that a while back. He's giving you the same phasing box, whether you're putting up four discrete quarter-wave verticals or these inverted V things which come together. And I really don't think that's going to be the same phasing point.
He's got something here that he rags about that.
okay, the so-called four-square, I think I understand the theory of operation there, and if he made the phase center of each of the elements of the inverted V versus the phase center of each of the elements of the four-square, if they're the same number of feet apart, I think maybe the phasing harness could be the same. Back to you, Barry.
Yeah, well, I'm going to turn over to Mel because he has the information. That's where I'm not so sure, because remember, these elements are coming back to the tower, and in the case of the verticals, they're not. And I got a feeling that shifts the phasing a little bit.
Go ahead, Mel.
The way he describes it, it can be used up to a 4 V-point assembly, up to 4. He definitely says, well, K3, let me tell you about K3LR. You take a look at the antenna system. You know, K3LR is the top contest station. I believe one of the top of the Fed in the United States right now. You take a look at his antenna system, Vic. It's beyond comprehension. You and my friends at Store went to Pennsylvania, not far from here, and they said, you got to see what's doing there. It's just a field of towers that stack beams on towers that are 175 feet tall and all that. He's got a tremendous setup. He's got 10 operating stations in a shack. And a whole business, each one with a kilowatt. He's really into this in a phenomenal way. So K3LR has done a lot of work in this field. And according to his article, I remember reading it, that he basically tells you you can duplicate with this phasing and all the switching business a 2 or 3 element Yagi effect on 160 or 80 meters, Dick, over.
Okay, and I think that's got a lot going for it. I'd much rather electronically rotate an antenna at 80 meters than mechanically. I mean, what's that guy over there in Japan, JR3 or the 7J4ALL, what he's doing is a brute force approach to mechanical rotating. I'd much rather see somebody electronically do that. Although I bet you, Barry, you dreamed about building a Yagi like that from time to time, haven't you?
Yeah, but every time I do, I get involved with UHF and VHF. And I'll tell you something, I'm only doing this project because they haven't fixed that satellite yet. And I believe by next year we're going to have maybe 2 really high orbit satellites. And you know where my attention is going to go after that happens.
Yeah, are these going to be quasi-synchronous or truly synchronous? Go ahead.
Okay, they're now talking about putting up one that might be fully synchronous. They're doing it in conjunction with some other satellite that's going up. I got to get back to that article. I will before this net is over tonight. I'll bring that one up. And also, the Germans and AMSAT North America are putting up these, high Earth orbit jobs, Millennium orbit type craft.
Yeah, those are very interesting orbits. And they served the Soviet Union, the Siberia area, very well. I mean, if this is the best of all worlds or universes, it would be very nice to be able to place a geosynchronous satellite directly over New York City, another one over Chicago, another one over San Francisco. But Mother Nature won't let you do that. Geosynchronous orbit has to be over the equator, and those cities are much too far north of the equator. But with this Malinya orbit, you can get much of the benefit of doing that. And they arranged it in such a way that the satellite would hang up directly over their area of Siberia during prime time every single night. It was a 24-hour orbital period where the perigee occurred very briefly on the backside of the Earth, and the apogee, with a nice long delay, occurred directly over Siberia during prime time. And that satellite served them very well. So I think you're saying AMSAT is coming up with one of these. I presume it's going to be launched from French Guiana. And has the bird already been constructed, Barry? Go ahead.
They're working on it now. In fact, they're talking about the construction. You go to the ASCAT website, which I'm going to do in a couple of minutes, and I can get you more information. So while you guys are talking, I'm going to look at that. Okay. So, Mel, to your knowledge, has anyone ever modeled with MiniNeck or any of these other programs the inverted V-type vertical dipole? Back to you, Mel.
I really don't know, Dick. This is K2KEY. Oh, by the way, let me not confuse everybody. The Comtec K3LR is an electronically steerable, he claims by electronically steerable, which is what you're looking at, that you're mentioning, that is the equivalent, he says, to a two or three element Yagi on 160 or 80 meters, depending on the system. If the electronic steerable system is controlled by six control lines, the remote antenna switching system that he developed for this has six control lines, he says, and it feeds four feed points. This is the assembly. In other words, he sells you the cut cables, you know, the harnessing, the coax cut up and all that business. He does all that, and then they sell you the switching boxes and all these goodies. I mean, he's got several ways he sells it, but this is the package. If you get the package with all these goodies, this is what you wind up with, an electronically steerable system to pick over.
No, this is the one that's got one of those ports is a dummy load. I don't understand what he's doing there, but that's the one you're talking about?
Well, you have the option. It's up to four. He's got it up to four feed points. But you don't have to use all four of them. That's it. You could close off one of the ports. But depends on, like I say, he's got so many different ways you can do this thing. I mean, the ultra way he mentions is with using the four feed points and then steering this thing, Barry, over.
Yeah, he's got four ports, but remember there are five terminals, and the fifth terminal is an always used 50 ohm dummy load. I don't understand what he's doing there.
I've got a guess on that one. Barry, you have from time to time talked about the strong possibility of building a really big beverage antenna around your QTH. In the case of a beverage antenna, you feed one end and terminate the other end. And that gives you a very desirable direction of radiation, unidirectional, parallel to the wire, so to speak. If you didn't have the termination, the reflected energy at the end that gets absorbed by the termination would reflect back, and your front-to-back ratio would degrade. So the termination is what is a high probability point, is a strong thing that gives you the front-to-back ratio. With this phased array, I am guessing the termination properly used can enhance front-to-back ratio. The average amateur says, gee, what in the world do I want to do that for? The last thing in the world I want to do is develop this valuable RF energy and pour some of it into a termination. Well, if you want front-to-back ratio, you have to do some terminating. So is it possible, Barry, that's what's going on? N2MB, K2LIW?
Could be. The other thing I was bringing up, the ANSAT's new, they have several satellites that they're working on, but the one that is kind of interesting is called Phase 4, and this is going to be in collaboration with Intelsat, who's putting up a geostationary satellite, and they're going to let ANSAT take a ride on that and put their package up with it. So that's going to be the first real geostationary satellite for amateur radio. That's interesting. And, of course, there are the other two projects, Phase 3E and Eagle. Phase 3E is German, AMSAT DL, and that's going to be a Mylania orbit, and Eagle is also going to be a Mylania orbit. Eagle, I think, is going to be a simpler package. In a way, I like that, because we've had some failures in the past, because I think they overcomplicated these things.
Very nice. I have a question, but I've forgotten it. Oh, well. And Mel, if you want to go to the mailbag again or continue the subject, choice is yours. I've got a mail.
Okay, this is K2KY. Yeah, let's go to the mailbag. It's late. I'd like to cover some of these dicks because, you know, overwhelms me. After a while, I hate to pass up on them. All right, let me look at a couple. Maybe you can do some quickie ones here. Quick, leave up. Okay, here's one. I've gotten a number of these questions. This gentleman by his name, Alec. He says, I went to a ham fest and I bought a receiver that really impressed me. It says it's Collins Model R390. It sounds terrific. Terrific shortwave receiver. However, when I listen to SSB on it, the audio is mushy, lousy audio. Is there any way I can do something about the SSB reception? And I've had this one a number of times. I can tell them exactly basically what has to be done on this receiver. Fairly familiar with the R390. But I had this question on a number of these receivers from the 50s, Dick, over.
In the early 50s, before receivers were specifically designed for single sideband reception with a so-called product detector, you had a EFO knob which allowed you to change the pitch of the Morse code you were listening to. And you could get a poor man's equivalent of a sideband receiver out of it by cranking the RF gain quite low to make sure that no saturation took place, cranking the audio gain up quite a bit higher to compensate for it, carefully adjusting the BFO and the main tuning knob, and you could get medium good single sideband reception. Not as good as a good product detector, and if you didn't do it just right, the filter passband wasn't in the right spot, and therefore you lacked the high frequency response of the original sideband signal. Is that sort of what we're talking about here, Mel? Go ahead.
Exactly. That's the problem. The original ones, like you say, they had a BFO to signal ratio system, and the envelope, what was called an envelope detecting system. So the way you change it around, you have to go to rewire it to a product detector. Now, there were several different ones. You know, in fact, they put out kits, literally. One of the kits that they put out was very interesting. They had a very good idea. I think you took it right. In other words, you connected right to the IF. Now, how did I connect it? They connected to the IF. Let me remember. It was a staggered tune. They had the IF system, I remember, the 390 is staggered tune. And they did sell a kit to basically take care of this. But basically what you're doing is you're going to a product detector. There were several articles that were written on how to convert to product detector. And I doubt if you're going to find the kit anymore. But basically that's what Dick is talking about, that you want to go from this BFO to signal ratio, the envelope type detector, to a product detector. I guess that's what that stands for, over.
Yeah, it'd be sure nice if Mutech made one of those conversion kits. Mutech is, a United Kingdom company that, for a number of the popular VHF receivers, they make a conversion kit that when you add it to your system, you end up with a much higher dynamic range, cleaner signal, less drift, all these kind of good things. I don't know if Mutech ever did that. Now, R390, a lot of them were built, a very popular receiver. But in its day, I don't think it was originally designed for sideband reception. By comparison, a real sideband receiver, a 51J, I think it's one of those, I'm not a Collins person, has a specifically shaped sideband resolution bandwidth IF filter, mechanical filter, with the right kind of a product detector, the right kind of signals going to it, and that gives you real hi-fi sideband. To your knowledge, Mel, has anyone ever written a good article on how to take a 390 and put in a good mechanical filter? Maybe they're on different IF frequencies, maybe that's the problem, but is there a way of putting in a good mechanical filter as well as the product detector and now making it a clean sideband receiver? because the rest of that receiver, with its permeability, tuned oscillator, good power supplies and whatever, other than the fact that it's a tube receiver, is an extremely good bulletproof receiver. KQKEY, KQLIW.
Roger, this is KQKEY. Like you say, they were made for the military and basically were for AM and CW reception. However, Colin did come out with the gadget. What the number is, I could never remember offhand. haven't looked at one in many years. And what it used was a companion, was called the companion single sideband adapter that fed by the IF output jack in the rear. If you look at the S390, you will find that it has an IF output jack in the rear. And all you do, what had to do is you plug in this single sideband adapter. Now you can find them. I've seen them. They're eBay every so often. They made a lot of them. And all you have to do is plug that in, and it works phenomenal. Has mechanical filters, the whole deal. It has a 2.1, if it's complete, of course, a 2.1 KHC mechanical filter. And it's, like I say, use the dial, the beautiful mechanical stability of that of the PTO, and you've got yourself a nice receiver for doing a lot of things. Because, you know, it's a very forgiving piece of equipment. It's extremely well built, Dick. Over.
It's G2NB.
Okay. New person. We'll get to you in a second. Mel, when you do that, the audio that comes out of that adapter that you connect to the back panel, do you then connect earphones to it, or does it go to a loudspeaker, or is the way that you put the audio back into the ART 390? Back to you, Mel.
Okay. The audio output of the adapter, if I remember correctly, was somewhere around, 600 ohms. Yep, 600 ohms. You used to use what they would suggest. In fact, that's what a lot of guys used to use on that. It was a pair of high impedance DC 3000 ohm headphones. They worked quite well. The 8 ohm output for the speaker. A lot of people complained that it just didn't have the audio that they liked. So what you could do, I used to see a lot of them, they would hook a hi-fi amplifier onto the back of it, just plug in a hi-fi amplifier, and it would give you beautiful audio, Dick. I think in most cases, the R390 was basically, they didn't really think of using it that much with the speaker. So it's got all these connectors on the rear that you can do a heck of a lot with it. Over.
That's a real a ceramic, you know what? I'm a receiver. The new person who joined us, please give us your call letters, your name, and then proceed with your question or comment, sir. KQLIW, my name is Dick.
Hey, how you guys doing? Is this a net? I hope it didn't interrupt some kind of tech net. Name here is Mark. Call sign is Kilowatt Golf 2 November Bravo KG2NB, located in Manhattan. Just wanted to get a signal report, but I didn't realize you guys were. Seems like you might be running some kind of a net.
Yeah, we run this tech net every Sunday night for the last 25 years and 1 month or 2 months, Mark, and. You got good sounding audio, good sounding RF, got a good sounding rig. Is that Kilo Golf 2 Nancy Bravo or Mike Bravo? Back to you, sir.
Nancy Bravo, KG2NB. Yeah, again, sorry for interrupting you on that. Didn't have anything to be tech-wise, but I'll get out of your way and let you guys carry on. It was an interesting conversation. I'll be on the side. Thanks again.
Very fine, Mark. Join us if you like. I guess there's enough audio output and audio input jacks on the front panel. You could, if you want to, take the adapter, the 600 ohm output, and probably plug it back into the audio. But I guess you're saying the audio of the basic rig was really intended to be earphone reception, and it's not that great on the 8 ohm loudspeaker reception. So a guy with a hi-fi, a good hi-fi connected to either of those audio outputs, the basic 390 or the sideband adapter, would be quite pleased. What's the approximate timing of the production of these things, if you happen to know, Mel? I'm guessing the R390 came first, and the 51J series, the real sideband receivers, were some number of years later, and then the equivalent of that single sideband adapter was built inside. It's a pure guess on my part. Is that somewhat like what happened?
Yeah, this is K2KEY. Well, what happened was with Collins, the 75 or 75J or 51J series, up until the J3 was actually, the 51J3 was actually not really also a single sideband receiver. This was also into the 50s. Single sideband really was pioneered, by Collins. I mean, they were very innovative, very forward with single sideband. Yet the call at the time was for mostly AM and CW. So until they came out with their real pure single sideband receiver that had all these filters and everything, and they had the product detector, the whole business complete was came out with the 51J4 or the Collins 75J4 receiver, completely remodeled. If you look at a 75J3 or a 51J3 series, and then look at the 4 series, like 75A4, it's a completely different system. Look at it. They really remodernized, modeled this thing, made a different cabinet, shrunk the cabinet down somewhat and all. So the 75A4 was really their epitome of that type of, type of receiver, the black box. Because that was the last of them on the deck over.
I vaguely remember that Collins, near the end, didn't they come out with a frequency synthesized receiver, Melgrad?
Hey, now we're talking about after this. This was after 57 towards the 60s, when they started in with their F line. That was the F line series. See, now we're talking after yes, and now they went to the S line. And they came out with a lot of very new receivers. And of course, moved that way, and the call was now for more compact equipment, getting away still boat anchors in today's respect for what's to do today. But if you look at the receiver, I have also a 75A4, but you put it next to a 75F3. It's like, a miniature version already of a Collins rig, It shrunk down from now to half the size almost. So this was now the trend to, first of all, they got away from the black panel. They got away from the black cabinet. They went to this light color gray. A whole redesign thing, but staying with things like their mechanical filters, that was their product. And they stayed with it, so it was basically now you went to newer tubes. They went got away from the octals and got into the 7-pin and 9-pin glass tubes. Over.
Yeah, I think they had the KWM380, which was their transistorized synthesized job, the first one. By the way, that was the amateur version. The military version of that, I don't remember the number, but it was out years before. And I saw it when I was in the Army. That's a very, very nice unit.
Wrong.
Go ahead, Bill.
Hey, everybody. Nope. The KWM-380 was Collins was gone. It was. That's why you look at a KWM-380. It said Rockwell Collins. What Rockwell wanted to do was sell the KWM-380 on the tail of the Collins Company. Collins Company was already defunct because I really keep up with Collins. Me and I'm really a guy full Collins man, read a lot of books about Arthur Collins of Zero CXX, so I know history and all things that he did and people and the whole business. He made a speech. And he says that our company, he says, we're not really us engineers, we're all, he basically says, I think we're dinosaurs, not in so many words. And we were very good at producing equipment, like you say, with vacuum tubes, boat anchor type, in that type of construction. And that, he says, this is it. That was the end. This is at the point where he lost the company over to Rockwell, Dick, over.
Now, being purchased by Rockwell, depending on what Rockwell's motivation was, could be good, could give him financial backing. And I wonder what motivation Rockwell had for buying them. Did they want that particular product line? Did they want a production factory in Davenport, Iowa, I think it was? Or is it, what's the name of the town in Iowa where Collins was located?
Cedar Rapids. And no, what happened was that the story was that there were certain patents that Collins held, such as the mechanical filter and a number of other patents, old government patents on that. You know, during the Cold War, you knew an antenna maven, so you may have seen that big umbrella antenna that Collins designed and was installing. You know what I'm talking about? By the silos, over.
Yes, I do. I know the one you're talking about. Go ahead.
Okay, that's what they wanted. They wanted those patents on those, on that antenna system. I don't know what they called that. What they called it. It must have been, let me describe the antenna. Something like a cone, yeah. I don't know. It was a cone type of design, over.
I'm not sure, but it may have been called an Adcock array, or it may have been called a Wallenweber antenna. Not positive of that, but it was a fairly exotic antenna. The method of construction was such that it would tolerate a nuclear blast that was quite close and allow you from your silo or from your bunker to continue to communicate. That's what I think was its main function. Mel, go ahead.
B2BXO.
Go ahead, Frank. Tell us what it is.
Mel, correct me if I'm wrong, or maybe Howie or Tony, if they're listening. Their mavens might. I believe QST showed that antenna, if I'm thinking of the right one, in QST a month or two ago. They called it a disc cage. Said there's still one at the at some Minuteman Silo Museum in Arizona that amateurs can drive up with a mobile rig and hook up a radio to. They called it a disc cage, apparently. It's what amateurs call a disc cone. Does that sound right, Mel?
I'm going to give you a cigar, Frank. You're right. That's right. I remember now. That's where I saw the picture recently. Yeah, I think it was a takeoff, just as Frank said, as a disc cone type of antenna. And that was the project of Collins, over.
I'm a little bit amazed that the disc cone was a patentable antenna. But I'll take your word for it. And maybe there was quite a few years left in that particular patent. A disc cone, to me, is a kind of a fat vertical ground plane. And it's got some other nice properties to it. But you think that's the main reason for the purchase. And after the purchase, they acquired the patent and then sort of took the company apart. Is that what happened? Go ahead.
Well, I don't know if that was the only primary one. That was the one that came to mind. It was a disc cone type of antenna. The amateurs call it disc cone. But Collins didn't call it a disc cone. It was a special design. The mechanics of it and everything, I can say, was meant to withstand a nuclear blast. Collins was known for building equipment that seemed like, it had to stop a 357 Magnum or something like that. But there was other things. Then there was the mechanical filter. They still held, the patent on the mechanical filter. And, just licensing out the mechanical filter was tremendous desire for them. It just never stopped. I don't know how many mechanical filters were manufactured, but they couldn't keep up, I understand, with the orders on that, that they had to branch that off as a separate product over.
Was Collins the only producer of the mechanical filter, or do you think Collins ever outsourced some of that, Mel? Go ahead.
Well, for the years that they had it as a patent, they were the only producer of the mechanical filter. You couldn't mention. Collins was a very tight-fisted company. People I spoke to that worked for them said he ran the company a bit with an iron fist. And this was one of his downfalls. He was not flexible enough on the Collins, and that's why, basically, that was his, the demise of the company, literally, was a lot of respect because of his sort of narrow thinking in certain aspects, especially when it came to the financial end of the company. He wasn't flexible enough because that company definitely was a viable company that could have continued, but he had a bit of a closed mind pick over.
Yep, sort of a control freak or a micromanager, and they can be troublesome, both to the troops and the overall health of a company and a project. Okay. Great stuff, those Collins filters. To your knowledge, Mel, did Collins make filters of 1.8, 2.0, 2.2, 2.4 kilohertz? Question number one. And number two, you can go to the next mailbag if you want to. You got it, Mel.
Query.
Go ahead, Bill. I think it's Frank.
No, but I have a question.
Okay. Here's your caller's name, sir, and then proceed with the question.
Thank you. Thank you. It's 70B2JKJ. My name is Joe. I wonder if you guys know anything about a Collins 651S-1 receiver, a digital receiver. Just listening to you, you sound like you might know something about something like this.
Go ahead, Mel.
Okay, it's KCK1, 61S1. Yep. That was another type of receiver that was basically not really designed by Collins exclusively. There was parts of it that were Collins, but the receiver was, it was quite a departure in looking at that receiver as to a Collins product, because it was, again, a different design called the 61S1. And I used one. It was quite a good receiver. It was made mostly, I believe, for military, because everyone that I know of was rack-mounted type part of a war equipment. It was made, I believe, if I'm not mistaken, most of them were used in the military as our RTTY, for RTTY reception, because I can remember also that the tuning scope that went with it. There was a tuning scope. That's another whole story. I have to have one of the panoramic display units that, this one was a little earlier version, but they readapted this thing to be used with the 61F. I got the one that I used with the Collins 7584. But Collins, yes, you asked me about the filters. They produced four filters. Very few people know. They only know the three filters. There was four of them. There was a 0.5, a 2.1, a 5, and an 8. That was the four filters they produced. I happen to have the four filters. I happen to have a receiver that I put the four filters into. So, but the 61S1 already was a bit of departure. I believe it was done. There was a company that was already, that was taking over. And, well, I could tell you a story, a quick story about a company called Harris Research. I'm sure you've heard of them, Dick, over.
Yes, I have. And when you come back, repeat those numbers again. 8 kilohertz was the wide one. Sounds like it was built for AM modulation. 0.5 was the narrow one. I guess there was a 0.5, a 1.5, a 2.1, and an 8. Or was there a 4 in there also? Well, Mel, go ahead.
Well, no, there was 0.5, then a 2.1. That was the combination of the CW sideband one. And then there was a 5, and then an 8 to follow the stick over.
Very good. Joe, did you have some further comments?
Thinking about something different. This thing that I'm looking at is a 651S1. 651S-1. Over.
Familiar with that one, Mel?
I'm trying to remember. I can't, maybe the 651F1, there was a couple that they produced for the Air Force. Maybe similar to the 618T,